This is The Intersection. My name is Mark Riley. The intersection of what? Politics and culture. Now, I've been away for a minute, had some personal things to take care of, but I am always, always glad to be back with you. We're going to start with a little bit of talk about abortion and the barbaric restrictions that have been passed to some degree or another in 8 states so far this year. Now, some might say, is barbaric too strong a term? Is it? I don't think so. Let's see. Who made this list of 8? Ohio, Alabama, Utah, Kentucky, Mississippi, Georgia, Missouri, and Arkansas all have passed legislation, several with no provision for rape or incest. I'll repeat that. No provision for rape or incest. That in and of itself is an example of barbarism on a very low scale. You know, there's a harder lesson to be learned here about the political landscape and how people will stick to their guns till they're almost at the point where they get what they want. Back in the day, I was one of those people who thought there was no way that the civil rights laws passed in the 1960s would ever be eroded. People used to come to me and they said, you know, we got to be vigilant about this. We got to make sure that they uphold the Civil Rights Act, uphold the Voting Rights Act, because there are going to be people who come after it and try and gut it. Well, you know, I told people they were being paranoid. And I'm here to tell you, I was wrong. Eventually, key provisions of the Voting Rights Act were eliminated. Is the price of complacency. Same thing has happened with abortion. Not that many people thought Roe versus Wade would be assaulted in the way it is. We now know better. Alabama is the worst offender, essentially banning abortions altogether. Yet if we look closely, we ought to be asking ourselves the following. How did we get here? And when will sanity in these states be restored? A couple of things you have to think about here. First, the majority of people who passed the bills in these 8 states were white men. That's right, white men. That means abortion is at risk through bills created lock, stock, and barrel in a context of America's continuing love affair with a white patriarchal society. When you have this many states and this many men who are involved in telling women what they can and cannot do with their bodies, I submit to you folks, one, that is an act of barbarism. The hope of those who would destroy a woman's right to choose is a trip to the Supreme Court. That's what all of these laws are about. They believe that a Trumpist majority will overturn the constitutionality of Roe v. Wade, which would be unique, or maybe not so unique. But what it would indicate is that America cares more about gun rights than women's rights. Go figure. Now, there are some people who have made the argument, I had a couple of people tell me this, that part of the reason why these states began passing all these restrictive laws against abortion had to do with the legalization of marijuana. And that as states began to essentially thumb their nose at the federal government and say, okay, you know, either by referendum or by an act of the legislature, we will legalize marijuana, it emboldened anti-abortion forces to come after Roe v. Wade. It's one of those situations people believed that there's no way in the world this could happen. Yet, it's happening. right before our very eyes. So that brings up the question, how do people who believe in a woman's right to choose fight back? I submit it has to be on several fronts. One, the census is coming up next year. The year after that, legislatures and congressional seats are drawn into districts. People have to resist the gerrymandering that causes state legislatures to be filled with the kind of people who would pass anti-abortion laws in the first place. What manner of man would say that we are opposed to abortion even in the case of rape or incest? What kind of human being is that? Now, I could sit here and draw examples of kids, young people, 14, 15, even some of them younger, who were raped, in some cases by a family member. And now in these states, the people who might intercede are facing serious criminal charges. How does that work? How in the world are you going to start locking up doctors who say, even, you know, even for rape or incest, I'm going to do the right thing. And if the young lady wants to terminate the pregnancy, I will oversee that. See, here's the great mythology about women who abort children or choose not to have a child is probably a more charitable and better term. It's not like they go out partying and get pregnant, abort the child, the next day go back out partying. That's not how it works for hundreds of thousands, if not millions of women across this country. Women who may have considered abortion and changed their minds, or women who decided to go through with it. And why might they go through with it? Let's say, for the sake of argument, the person who got them pregnant suddenly vanishes. And the woman is faced not just with having to provide for herself, but having to raise a child. And if the person who is abandoned is young, they have no experience in raising a child. They just don't. And this is the environment. This is the nonsense that people in these eight states want to create, because they believe that women who get pregnant out of wedlock have somehow sinned. That's what they believe. They may talk all they want about a fetal heartbeat and when does life start and all of that, but their aim is to punish. Their aim is to say to women who have the temerity to get pregnant and seek to do what they choose with their bodies, no, we are not going to allow you to do that. That's what this is about. Ask yourself the following question, ladies and gentlemen. Is there a circumstance under which women have the right to tell men what to do with their bodies? Imagine that. Women telling men, hey, you can't do this, you can't do that. If you're a rapist, you have to have a vasectomy. And, you know, there are people who have actually lobbied in that regard, and not all of them women. But this is the central question. And to me, the answer is there is no circumstance under which a woman or a group of women or the whole of women in this country can dictate to men what they do with their bodies. It does not happen. Now, if you want to go to the extreme and say, well, okay, if a woman declines to have sex, that is a woman telling a man, at least in one instance, what they cannot do with their bodies. But that has to do with the woman. So I don't see it. I do not see a circumstance under which women would control men's bodies. You want to talk about a right to choose movement? Imagine if that were to happen. Now, there has to be a reconstruction, dare I say it, of state legislatures in these 8 states that passed this legislation, especially Alabama. There has to be an entire sweeping of the carpet of the people who passed this kind of legislation. They got to go. It's as simple as that. And yeah, it's going to be hard. It's going to be especially hard in a state like Alabama, where you have large numbers of people who oppose abortion. But it can be done. And the only way I can think of to codify and assure and make secure the right of women to control their own bodies is a constitutional amendment that protects women in every state from the egomania and sexism that produced these restrictions. I'm going to repeat that. The egomania and sexism that produced these restrictions. These invasions of women's rights are viewed, certainly in the 8 states. So I saw one vote, it was like 110 to 44. Wasn't even close. But this is viewed as perfectly normal. Normal behavior. I don't understand it. I really do not understand how people in their right minds can sit there and tell a woman, you have no right to choose. Because that's what they're saying. Once certain circumstances are in place that we dictate a fetal heartbeat or whatever, once that happens, you are no longer in control of your own body. You're not. We are not going to allow you to have an abortion. And again, I've been around abortion clinics. And the one thing that people get wrong, as I mentioned earlier, is this notion that people are dancing around having a party in an abortion center. Many of the women who come there are young, they're scared, they've been abandoned by a boyfriend who they thought loved them. All of these things are at play, and we act as though there's no big problem with this. Well, there is. It's as simple as that. And we have to, and there are certain states, New York is one of them, that have written into state law a woman's right to choose. Now, maybe that's what needs to happen in all 42 states that didn't go crazy here. But the bottom line is, men and women need to stand up and need to say, we're not tolerating this from you. We are going to end up in a situation where our grandkids and our great, great, great grandkids are going to look back on this time and they're going to ask themselves, my God, what were these people thinking? How in the world could they have created this kind of impediment, not in the entire country, but in select states, and criminalize abortion services and abortion service providers? That is absurd. Interestingly enough, our president says he does not support the parts of the law that do not exempt rape and incest. It's real big of him, if I say so myself. There is going to come a time when we will all be judged. And this is one example of it. And how we respond, whether we just sit back and say, well, okay, well, let it go to the Supreme Court, and if the court rules against Roe v. Wade, well, then so be it. It's the settled law of the land. Do not think for an instant that there aren't a large number of Americans who look at it that way and who don't think there's anything to fight about. I, for one, happen to be one of those who think that these laws are worth fighting, and beating back. There's no reason why it can't be done. Thank you so much for listening. My name is Mark Riley. The 2020 elections are around the corner, next year, in fact. What issues are going to be important to you and whichever candidate you choose, if you have chosen one yet? Send me an email, mark@markrileymedia.com. When we come back, immigration, White House style. To the intersection. I'm Mark Riley. So I really hate to do this because I don't like to talk about the man who's the president of the United States, and I'm certainly not responding to 5 a.m. tweets on his part. This time, it's about something he did in broad daylight. It was his White House announcement of what he calls a comprehensive immigration reform plan. It looks as though his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, was the driving force behind this scheme. I imagine, and I've read some reports that bear it out, that Stephen Miller probably had a hand in it as well. Stephen Miller is a hardline anti-immigration member of the Trump inner circle. The plan would change the way migrants would be judged fit to enter the U.S. Right now, more than 60% of legal permanent residents in the U.S. come here by way of family ties. 12%, or thereabouts, are admitted by way of their skill set. This proposal would change that to 57% by skill, 33% by virtue of family ties. It is, at the end of the day, a very well-constructed smokescreen. Many pundits say it has no chance of passing the Congress, which may be fine as far as Donald Trump's concerned. He can say he tried to do something on immigration, came forward with a plan, and those left-wing liberal Democrats, particularly in the House, refused to go along with his plan. And his plan at first glance seems to be relatively mild. It would not, by way of information, change the numbers of people who get green cards annually. That it would not change. It would just change the composition of the people who got the green cards, not the number. What's most interesting about this initiative on the part of the president, assuming he had something to do with it, assuming he read and signed off on what Kushner and Miller that is put together, the question is, for me anyway, whether their forebears would have been allowed in the United States if the plans he's come up with were the law of the land when they tried to come. Now, let me say right at the top, this is an imprecise science, but we do have a few facts. So let's do a dive, courtesy of our friends at Quartz. Donald Trump's mother came to the United States in 1929 by way of chain migration. I wonder how many points she would have rated on this new merit-based plan that her son came up with. The president's paternal grandfather came from Germany to join his sister. Sounds like chain migration to me. Vice President Mike Pence also came by way of chain migration from Ireland, along with a number of siblings. Jared Kushner's paternal grandparents were Holocaust survivors who were made to wait in an Italian camp for displaced persons before being allowed into the U.S. Gee, does that sound familiar to anybody? Stephen Miller, the most hawkish of the immigration hawks, wants a requirement that immigrants pass an English exam in order to become citizens. That's ironic, given that Miller's great-grandmother couldn't speak English and his great-grandfather flunked the citizenship test. But he was allowed to stay anyway. Think about that for a minute. So the president, the vice president, Jared Kushner, and Stephen Miller have all benefited from a chain migration that took place inarguably a long time ago. But one has to question if any of them would be here absent that chain migration, which they are now prepared. And by the way, this is only the first step. If they get it done, they are prepared to grind this kind of chain migration into the ground, into the ground. Their families got here okay. Their families used it. They don't want other people's families to use it in the modern time. Then, of course, there's the Knobs family, Donald Trump's in-laws, and the poster children for chain migration. The very chain migration that Donald Trump has spent quality tweeting time disparaging. But never mind the obvious hypocrisy in all this on the part of all of these people who had something to do with putting this plan together. They're all hypocrites, every last one of them. But you see, he's doing this, the president, to burnish his immigration credentials for next year when he's going to run for re-election. I mean, it doesn't take a genius to figure that one out. He does have one advantage, and that advantage is given to him courtesy of the Democrats. The Democrats don't have a plan. I'll repeat that. The Democrats don't have a plan. I guess they think they can just let Trump keep spinning this stuff, and all they have to do is sit back and watch him self-destruct. It isn't going to happen. This may not get through Congress. Trump may have known when he proposed it, it wasn't going to get through Congress. A lot of people in Congress were talking big smack about it. They made Jared Kushner sound like an idiot when he went and met, I believe, with Senate Republicans. And they said he, at least one of them said, that he appeared clueless. The guy who wrote this is described by one person who met with him as clueless. That's, how best to put this? Not the best of circumstances in terms of people trying to put together a plan, A, that can pass the Congress, B, get signed into law by the president, assuming you agree with what he's doing, which I don't. But assuming you do, how happy can you be with a plan that has no chance? And how cynical is this president to think that by proposing it, knowing it's not going to pass, knowing it will never get near his desk, does it anyway so he can go bring a little bit more red meat to his base? Now, I've talked before about Donald Trump's base, and I'm not going to get into great detail about it now, but I have to say, this is, for him, as far as he's concerned, a winning strategy. Continue to pound away. And by the way, the tariffs, he thinks, is also a winning strategy. The tariffs against the Chinese. He thinks that that's going to work for him. And maybe it will. I'm not going to write it off completely. You know, a lot of people wrote this guy off in 2016. And you see where he is now and has been. So I'm not ready to write it off. But I am ready to say that if the Democrats don't agree with it, and there might be a few that might, you never know. But if the Democrats do not agree with it, they must be held accountable for coming up with a better alternative. You know, we can't, and when I say that, let me say that there are some Democratic candidates for president, I won't name them, but there are some Democratic candidates for president who have, in fact, come up with immigration plans. But they speak for themselves. They are one of a competing number, 23 altogether, of people who want to be president and to some degree or another care about immigration. Some more than others, maybe. So there have been those people. But the party, which is not in power, needs to come up with a plan. And I've been saying this for a long time now. The Democrats have yet to do a great job in defining for people who they are and why people should vote for them. Now, on certain levels, I mean, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and many others across this country are exceptions to this in terms of taking a message to the public and being able to win with it. And in AOC's case, being vilified for it. But there needs to be a plan. And I, for one, am not picky about where it comes from. It should come, I believe, from the Democratic National Committee. After all, they are, at least were supposed to have been, the voice of the Democratic Party. So why shouldn't they? Why shouldn't they stand up and say, if this is what they believe, this immigration nonsense that Donald Trump has brought up, switching the percentages of people, making it more and more difficult for people who might have language problems or may not have had the best education in their home countries, it's going to make it that much more difficult for them and their families to come here. That's the bottom line. And he now is able, and did say, in fact, oh, Republican Party loves immigrants. I love immigrants. I think they're wonderful. Different tune than what he was talking about, Mexicans and others, but let's say for the sake of argument that we take him at his word. And that, yeah, he does love immigrants. And yeah, he wants to reform the system, which needs reform. Let's not get silly about that. But does it need this kind of reform? I would argue absolutely not. It doesn't need this kind of reform. But again, as is the case with abortion, people are going to have to stand up and tell the people in their own party, their allies, that we need to come up with something as a party. Take a piece of this one's proposal and a piece of that one's proposal, whatever you got to do. But you've got to come up with something. And it's got to be smart. And it's got to be something that will get the backing of large numbers of Americans. I believe with every fiber of my being that immigration could be one of the defining issues in next year's elections. That's why the Democrats have to get it right. They have to be smart. They have to outthink the Republicans, which is not impossible. Trust me. They put their pants on one leg at a time, just like Democrats do. We have to be able to communicate with the American people, all of the American people, not just the middle class, not just white people, not just black people, all Americans. We have to be able to say, this is our plan. And it makes sense, and it'll work, and together we'll make it happen. And to leave the future of immigration in this country to a group of people who are so hypocritical that they ignore their own past in order to get this done, as if their ancestors were better than the people who are trying to come here now. That's what they're saying. They know their own history. They're not stupid. Well, they're not stupid. But bottom line, you've got to try and have a situation where people are prepared to fight and people are prepared to win. It's as simple as that. I'd love to hear from you at my Facebook page, Mark Riley Media. Please, don't be shy. We have a final segment coming up on another question, and no, it's not about Game of Thrones because I don't watch it, but it's about a really interesting topic to me, reality television. Please stay with us.
You're listening to the intersection of politics and culture with Mark Riley.
Welcome back to The Intersection. I'm Mark Riley, and thank you so much for staying with me. Our final segment today is about reality television. Not one of my favorite things, but certainly one of my more guilty pleasures. The question is, when does reality television go too far? Across the pond, over in England, the Jeremy Kyle show, which is a sort of malevolent take on Jerry Springer, has been canceled after a guest committed suicide after failing a lie detector test, which, by the way, is suicide is not commonplace, but the use of lie detectors on the part of many of these reality TV shows, you could make a case that it's gotten out of hand. And you could also make a case that maybe they're not always as accurate as they project themselves to be. But at any rate, Kyle's program had been on television in England for 14 seasons with a steady diet of accusations, lie detector results, recriminations, and in theory, resolution. My guess is despite its popularity in the UK, many over there won't lament the passing of this show. A lot of people really felt that this kind of confrontational, grind people into the dust kind of television has no place in a civilized media landscape. But of course, been there for 14 years. Jerry Springer, who I understand has recently been canceled as well, had been around for 25 years. 25 years. Now, Jerry didn't start out doing what he's doing, to be fair. It sort of evolved into the circus sideshow that program has been for a good long time. And I guess people ought not try and lump all reality television, you know, in one particular barrel. It got me thinking all this about reality TV here in the States. And of course, the genre does, in fact, run the gamut from Dr. Phil to Springer, to Steve Wilkos, to the now 90 Day Fiancé, as ubiquitous as that franchise has become. And bit of confession here, I can't lie. I've watched several of them, and I kind of tell myself when I do, and when my wife gets on my case about it, that I watch it on account of because it's funny. It's a comedy to me. I've counted the number of times Dr. Phil has used one of a couple of dozen hackneyed cliches to make a point with a guest, or how he manages to casually drop mention of his books, published, of course, by his son, who runs Bird Street Books. And, you know, you can't fault the guy for tooting his own horn. He's had I don't know how many number one bestsellers, but they all have an angle. They all have a way of doing things. I see Steve Wilkos, who's an ex-cop from Chicago, the most intimidating host and former Jerry Springer security guard, casually dropped mentions of his wife, who happens to be the executive producer of his show. Then there's Iyanla Picks My Life, with relationship expert and self-proclaimed cultural custodian, Iyanla Van Zandt. That one might as well be called Blame Somebody. You know, she does these digs and dives and usually ends up faulting somebody's mama or daddy or somebody, while simultaneously trying to get whoever it is that came to her in the first place to admit some level of responsibility. And, you know, then the healing, as she puts it, can begin. Now, no one in their right mind wants to say that reality television ought to be banned. Least of all, me. I mean, God, I watch it, for goodness sake. But I wonder the extent to which it will continue the process of having people watch it and act as though the people who are the hosts are somehow transformational. Now, you know, maybe they are for some people. They're not for me. I'm not saying they're bad people. I'm just saying, you know, I cannot envision a circumstance under which I would appear on any, I repeat, any of these television shows. All of these shows, one thing they have in common, the ones that are still around, they make a person or persons, including production staff, quite wealthy, exposing the foibles of everyday human beings. And in some cases, you can cross out foibles and say pathologies. Because some of the people that are on these shows are nuts. But they're everyday human beings. Just like the people and the audience on Jeremy Kyle were everyday human beings. And the people who defend this kind of television will tell you, hey, we don't go out necessarily and look for these people. What we do is invite them to write us. And particularly on the most popular shows, I'm sure Dr. McGraw gets literally tens of thousands of letters a month asking for his help. So he can pick and choose who he wants. And some of the others can do the same. They can just say, okay, well, this one's all right. And this one will make good television. Or this one really needs my help. They all have something. They all have a hook. They're like music in the old days. I wanted to say records, but most people don't know what records are if they're young. But the bottom line is, there's a hook. There's something that these hosts, facilitators, however you want to describe them, and remember that not all reality television shows have hosts. There's no host of 90 Day Fiancé. When they ask some of the contestants there, or the guests, or whoever they are, about, so it's the producer. There's no host. You know, and there are others. Wendy Williams is a reality TV show. A reality TV show, I think, and I mean, I knew Wendy in a previous life. It's a reality TV show that may not really want to reflect certain realities. But the bottom line is, in the society in which we live, and it's not all that different from Britain, the bottom line is, if you make money, you're around. If you're not making money, you're gone. And I wonder if Jeremy Kyle's numbers may have slipped. I have no empirical evidence about this. I do not know. But I'd be very interested to know, because they really just sort of dropped him like third period French. And certainly the suicide of a guest is nothing to sniff at. They may have decided, the people that put the Jeremy Kyle show on the air, ITV over in England, they may well have decided that there was no way that Jeremy Kyle could offer support to people who are troubled and on his show. There are people who make the argument that some shows put people who are to some varying degree mentally disabled on these programs. Now, I don't want to say that that's necessarily a fact. I haven't seen it. At least I haven't seen it enough to know it. But if that's happening, that's reprehensible. There seem to be, certainly in this country, an unending stream of people that want desperately to see if they can grab onto a bit of fame by being on TV. There was one woman that was on 90 Day Fiancé, and I think she was on Maury as well. Now, Maury has a different twist. Maury's thing is, you are or are not the father of a child. And what you got to realize is these are not actors. None of them in any of these shows are actors. Some people argue that the producers of certain shows hype the guests to overact or to be overdramatic or to start hollering and screaming or whatever. I don't know. All I know is this latest thing with Jeremy Kyle, who I used to watch when I was over in England more than once, it makes me wonder whether there's anything wrong with me watching these kinds of shows. I don't know. Please hit me up. Enlighten me. Let me know. You know, email me, mark@markreillymedia.com. Tell me, hey, stop watching that stuff. I just am not sure. And, you know, while we're on the subject, what exactly constitutes a reality TV star? I've seen stories, don't ask me why, but I've seen stories that call certain people reality TV stars. You know, I know what a TV star is, a film star, you know, a theatrical star. I know what those kind of stars are. Paul Newman was a star. They had some stuff on him earlier today on TV. He was a star. There are others that were stars. Denzel Washington, a star. But a character in a reality TV show, a star? I've been wondering this for a long, long time. Because there are people who believe with every fiber of their being that the people they see on TV are in fact stars. And that there's a little, no matter how dysfunctional they may be or whatever, but they see a little sliver of themselves and a little sliver of wanting to be that person because they're on TV. Not because they have a great life, because some of the people on 90 Day Fiancé, my God, but because they're on television. That is the reason and the only reason why people want to get on TV. They see ordinary folks becoming stars, and they say to themselves, why, oh, why can't I? Thank you all so much for listening. I really appreciate it. And until we meet again, please be well. Thank you.